Friday afternoon deploy is the third cup of coffee on the road to Zen.
That is fantastic. For those of you, so I've just mashed the magical red button. For those of you
excellent.
Who missed the amazing analogy we just received with Meredith, did I get it?
Yes.
Yes, I hit it. And we'll go back into all the training that it took to get me there on the first attempt in just a moment. But Meredith just described how dangerous it is. Cycling in the UK to work. And so here in the States, everyone's just like, oh, a cycle to work day. Everybody needs to cycle. We got greenways here in Northwest Arkansas that span the length of everything that is a city you would want to work in. But the reality of cycling to work in the UK is vastly different, and they will come for you, according to Meredith.
Like, background for those who are listening, I live in Cambridge, which is possibly the most cycle-dense city west of the Netherlands.
Is it really? Cambridge is that like, much cycling in it.
Well, just like geographically, geologically, topographically, it is a pancake. And so it is so easy to get anywhere on a bicycle. Plus, it has a huge student population who aren't allowed cars, but are allowed bicycles, which means that it gets a slightly domesticated population of drivers who understand that drunk students might emerge suddenly from a side street without warning. And so they're usually fairly cautious. It's the buses you have to watch out for.
I love the acknowledgement that the students will be drunk. As someone who lives in a university town, it is always a safe bet that when, particularly when you're in like the general campus area, because there are laws here that supersede normal laws. And I believe that's the case with most university towns, is that when you're within a certain diameter or within a certain region within the university, you yield to the pedestrians to a degree that is just completely over the top. It's one thing to say like you yield to pedestrians, but within the university crosswalk system, the pedestrians have complete control and they can walk out in front of you whenever they want to, and you have to screech to a stop. And so there's this beautiful juxtaposition of as a very freedom-focused, my rights-focused nation, as we all know, you get all of a sudden these people who are used to driving their car going like, I'm in a car, don't you jaywalk and get in front of me, versus all of these people who are at the university who've been taught like, no, literally, just start walking. Everyone has to stop for you. And those people are just like, no, it's my freedom. I'm going to walk right here. Don't you get your car in front of my freedom. It's a beautiful place. I had to punch the hood of a car once. Because I was crossing a crosswalk, and they thought in the midst of me crossing, it's not like they were there and I like jumped out in front of them to beat them.
Mm-hmm.
They were sitting at a stop sign, clearly waiting for me to go, or so I thought. And midway through my going in front of their car, they decided like, I'm going to go now. Or they looked up from whatever Instagram, what have you chat they were in, and started to go. And I had to just put my fist right in the front of this car. Boom! And then all of a sudden they woke up and it's like, oh, wait. I would still get in trouble if I killed this person with my car. And it's like, yeah, don't do it. So
I've been on the other side of that with like five students just walking down the street. Like the movie Tombstone or something. And I've had to honk at them to go like, this isn't a crosswalk. This is a street. There are sidewalks over there.
Yeah. And to your point, like the students who leave that region don't realize they've lost like their zone of comfort. And so they walk about the rest of the town with that same sense of entitlement, which will get them killed if they're not careful. So yeah, cars and cycling and walking. Who knew how complicated it would be when we decided to all get to work or school in different ways?
Like, I mean, all we did was put like 2 tons of metal traveling at like 60 miles an hour in close proximity to soft, squishy humans. What could possibly go wrong?
Nothing. It's amazing that anything happens, because I mean, we just need to put everybody in pillow suits. You go for a walk, you throw on your pillow suit so that you know
they need.
Oh,
have you seen those Zorb balls?
Yes. Yes,
yeah. Like, so you can do Zorb football or Zorb soccer, as you would probably call it, where you put somebody in like an inflatable sort of ball that's like most of the person's height, and they run around attempting to play a perfectly ordinary ball of game of football. Only the moment they get close enough to each other, then you know they're over on their
butt. That's where you get the benefit. Like, that's where the joy of actual football and American football can really come together. Because that's when you get that guy who's just like, I'm going to light up the quarterback, except he's going to light up whoever goes to that soccer ball, mm-hmm. that football, and he can just knock them over. And it's,
if the YouTube videos and GIFs I've seen are any guy, the point is that they bounce comedically when that happens, right. Which just really adds to the joy all around.
My concern is that that's not reality. Like, I've been this close to buying that and just going like, you know what? I've been sold so many lies that I'm pretty sure that someone's going to get their neck broke if everybody just kind of takes it for granted that these Zorb balls will absorb everything. And then so what I thought about was, there are helmets that I've seen, particularly marketed in European nations. They're helmets that inflate to like have this huge neck suppression face shield. Around, I don't know if you've ever used one or known someone who has.
I have not used one, but one of my colleagues does, and there's real danger there, because obviously the thing itself is electronic normally. Right. So if you haven't seen one, it looks like a really like very small. It's like smaller than a scarf when it's normally clipped around your neck.
Exactly.
And the idea is that it will inflate like all around the back of your head, and
cover your head, exactly.
Yeah, turn into a helmet.
Yeah.
Just like in the moment of falling off your bike before you hit the ground. The problem is, of course, like that thing, you know, has no magical sense of the world. It has accelerometers in it, and so the only way it knows that you are falling is because all the gravity just went away. And this colleague of mine made the fatal mistake of activating their helmet before getting on the bicycle, and then tripped over in their garage. Yes, there was a loud bang, and all the housemates came running to find them sort of staring at the ceiling, wondering what exactly just happened to them.
That's amazing. Oh yeah, that's the funny one, because of course, and this gets back to the whole point of our broader conversations. We've taken something that's a very safe and reliable thing like a helmet and decided, like, that needs software. We could do that better. Who needs a helmet when we just drape something around our necks and add some software to make it a helmet? And
firmware makes everything better.
Oh, it's... Oh. What could go wrong? What could go wrong? Except it was probably built in JavaScript, so we know what could go wrong. Yeah, exactly. Here's what's fun. So we're really excited to have Meredith on the podcast with us. And again, I'm gonna get back to proper pronunciation of name, because
if only to take your victory lap for nailing.
Oh yeah. Oh no. Exactly. I have to preen like a peacock. Like, I'm going to strut around here in a minute when you explain it all. But but I would argue the only guest who's been more. Practically, I'll say practically, not vocally. We've been very vocally anti-JavaScript in various podcasts, but I've not known someone to be so practically anti-JavaScript as you have been to produce the tooling and the product that you have with Anvil. And so I will take that to step away and allow you to introduce yourself, sir, and the tooling you have, and explain why I am so proud. So proud that I can say your name without sounding like an idiot.
All right. So my name is Meredith. I'm a founder of a company called Anvil. We make tools whose primary benefit to humanity is that you can build an entire full stack web app and deploy it without having to touch a line of JavaScript. there's a tool you can get to at anvil.works. It's like an online editor. Did you ever use Visual Basic back in the day, either of you?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sadly. Yeah. Getting a lot of nodding on the Zoom.
Yep.
So it's basically like Visual Basic, only like new and for the web. So you open it up, you get a drag and drop editor where you can put together a web page. If you double click on any button, suddenly you're writing some Python code that runs when the button gets clicked. All of that is happening in the browser because this is a full stack web app. That Python gets compiled to JavaScript, so you didn't have to get any of it on you. And of course, there's also like a serverless environment, so you can define some server-side Python and call a function, the server-side Python from the client-side Python, deploy it on a hosted service. There's a whole bunch of off-the-shelf integration, so you don't have to worry about, oh, I don't have to implement user authentication for the 15th time this week. I mean, you're an agency, you must be... No, I know you don't like that word, sorry, but like agency-type company.
You're good.
Consultancy.
Your awareness was fantastic, by the way. Like just that is like, oh, he...
I got in there before somebody slapped me. But like you must know that there are an awful lot of things that you build every day, and there's this huge difference between like the essential complexity of your client has come to you with a need, with a business process, with something that the user needs to be able to do, and then the that's sort of essential complexity, and then there's all this incidental complexity of how actually to make a computer do that. And the weird thing about the web is that we've taken we've done it. We finally did it, humanity. We built the universal app platform that anybody can build something that anyone can use from anywhere in the world. And it's fantastic. And then we set up a sign outside saying you must be this tall to ride this ride. And this tool is no like HTML and JavaScript and CSS and Python and SQL and React and Redux and Webpack and Bootstrap. And I mean, it's just insane. And so at a certain point, my friend Ian and I specifically, we know each other from we studied together. We both did our PhDs here in Cambridge. Mine's in usable programming systems. His is in human-computer interaction. And if that's your background, you spend a lot of time bitching to each other about the web being really impossible to use. And at a certain point, we just flipped the table and went, fine, like someone has to fix this. It might as well be us.
I've got bad news for you. It doesn't take a PhD to do that. We do that all the time. And I've got an English and political geography degree, and Alan doesn't even have a degree. So I hate that it took you down that journey to realize it, but yeah.
Oh, I mean, I feel like
you get to say
many people
you
realize
say
it
far
it.
More articulately. You can make your point even more well known, and people trust you. We're just
idiots
for the podcast who builds software.
It may maybe like 40% that, 60% like just like a few years research will like really grind your face into like all the things that the web gets wrong. You know how there's nothing worse than having expertise in an area in question when that area gets featured in a Hollywood film or in a TV series.
Oh yeah.
Like it's technobabble, but like it being your field makes it like nails down a chalkboard. People know that the web is bad. If your field is programming usability, it's just like, ah!
Absolutely. That's really good.
Just that the idea was fine. You know what? There is no actual reason it has to be this hard. Like the world, generally speaking, learns Python as the first programming language. Obviously, exceptions, but like it's the world's most common one. There's no reason you couldn't actually make a UI on a screen with a button that does something when you click it in, three lines of code. There's no reason you shouldn't. So we made the system that actually made that possible.
Yeah. Well, that's kudos. You took the red hot rage you felt and turn that into a product that would allow you to not have to ever do that again. We just turned it into
into
a podcast.
We
That's what I was going
to
say was my guess is you're the ones doing it, so no one else has to. I know, spoilers, we'll dive into some of the tech of this later, but I know like you guys are writing stuff in Sculpt, but I imagine that can only go so far. You can only Python so far before you scrub in and go touching the DOM.
And like we have to implement it, right? So if we want to give you a UI toolkit where you can drag and drop build your user interface and or you know treat everything on your page as a Python object rather than like the current way, if you think about it, the current way is nuts. You generate source code in one programming language that has source code in another programming language embedded in it. And then you write a third programming language also embedded in it to style that into pixels. What were we smoking? Instead of doing that, you can just, you know, manipulate a Python object. I want the text on that button to say hello. You know, self.button1.text equals hello. But what that means is that if we want to build a UI toolkit like that, then we are the ones who have to build it, which means that we have to, as you say, do all the DOM manipulation. We build the Python to JavaScript compiler. We build this, you know, great big editor that where you actually, you know, design your applications. And so, yes, I do like to say that there is a forehead-shaped dent next to my keyboard marked, I'm doing this so you don't have to.
That is beautiful.
Yeah. Admirable.
Yeah. I have to laugh at that. So you guys maintaining, so I know, Like I mentioned that you guys are using Sculpt. Are you guys maintaining Sculpt now? Have you gone that far?
So
yeah.
If I thought that if might be where it's
going.
It.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, well, if you're not familiar with it, so Sculpt is a Python to JavaScript compiler. So it's just a library you can, I think you can NPM install it these days. You feed it like a Python program. It will spit out JavaScript that will do the same thing as that Python program. By the way, it is the ugliest JavaScript you've ever seen. Do not view source. But it produces JavaScript.
Don't ever view source. We know this. Like, just go to the LinkedIn website and view source and view console and watch all the sea of errors. Yeah.
It's compiler output. As you say, like, everything else on the web is compiler output.
Right.
I'm one of the maintainers of Sculpt these days. We have another of them, on our team. Stu does a lot of work. So it's not that we've, taken over the project, but we do contribute heavily to it, and we are unsurprisingly friendly with the rest of the folks who work on it. It's a really cool project. It's like there's a whole bunch of people who will look at the web and look at it and go, well, that's a tire fire, correct? And the problem seems to be all this JavaScript, and if only I didn't have to write JavaScript, I could escape this hell. And that's the part where I start to disagree, because the problem with the web isn't really necessarily the fact that there's JavaScript involved. JavaScript itself is actually at least a kind of neat language in a bunch of different ways. But the problem is it's embedded in a system where like your data is going to be it's rows in a database, and then you have to turn it into objects in your server-side code. I don't know what you guys use on the server most of the time.
On the server?
Yeah.
Python
usually.
Yep. Yeah, there we go. Yes, same as many other people. So, okay, so you've got data in database table. You've got to turn it into a Python object. So you're no longer accessing it by SQL. You're accessing it by methods and attributes. And then you turn around and mash it into JSON, which is accessed over like REST endpoints with like get, post, put, delete. It's a weirdly limited set of verbs, but then lots of different endpoints. But on the other end, of course, what's happening it's immediately getting turned back into objects in JavaScript. Accessed by their own like methods and attributes, and then you have to render that into DOM with its own like kind of peculiar API, and then you use CSS to render that into pixels. And like that's like the day-to-day work of web programming is not so much getting your business goals done, it's doing all those transformations. And of course, managing like the frameworks we have. Like obviously we don't do that by hand. We have ORMs helping us turn the database objects into objects. We've got REST frameworks helping us to serve them. We've got templating engines like React helping us render those JavaScript objects into DOM, but like the care and feeding of those frameworks is, you know, and that translation is the day-to-day work of web development. And so if you just knocked out JavaScript and put Python in there just on its own, like you might have a good feeling for a day or two, But then you'd be realizing you'd be solving all the same problems. Like, if you are driving React and Redux with Python, you're still dealing with all the complexity of React and Redux. And now you, it's worse because none of the things you copy and paste off Stack Overflow will work because they're in a different programming language. So, yeah, so it's not just about replacing JavaScript with Python. So Sculpt for us is, it's a really cool project, but it's an enabling technology in something a little bit bigger than just going, you know, my language rocks, your language sucks.
Yeah. I appreciate that because my anti JavaScript leanings have just driven me to Elm, which I've learned is just not sustainable yet. We'll see one day. There's a talk. We're also like attending Strange Loop virtually. So I don't know if you're familiar with the conference Strange Loop in St. Louis.
I haven't attended, but it's one of those things that tends to throw out fun videos from time to time.
They're fantastic. We love it. We're attending virtually, and Richard. Oh gosh, what's Richard's Feldman? Richard Feldman is one of the main evangelists for Elm. He's giving one of the next talks we're all going to hop to after we get off of this call, and so I'm definitely pro Elm because it's functional, but more importantly, it's not JavaScript, and so that's a lot of fun. But you've turned that, and you've got like the body stacked in the corner. You've not just gone after JavaScript; you've gone after everything, like Tom Christie. As far as you're concerned, is kind of over there in the like, we don't need. And that's no offense to Tom; he did tremendous things. But in your paradigm, in your worldview, which is fascinating to hear you describe, and I've seen it in a couple talks at this point. And as you go through that list of all of the places where we're casting things and we're changing things and adapters and all that, you're just like, no, everything's a Python object. And I've not gone that deep. I've just been like, I just want to not have to write JavaScript. But I've also gotten comfortable with just writing JavaScript at the same breath, and found ways to do that in a way that I find fulfilling. And so what I love about what you've done is you've gone, okay, cool, and you've gone and really embraced the things that you love about Python and tried to put those literally everywhere. And that's admirable. Like that's very admirable. So.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that you're a sucker if you use JavaScript every day for your job. Apart from anything else, it would make looking in the mirror in the morning rather difficult.
Yeah,
but
yeah. I've seen what you've done.
What I've said earlier, but you know what I've done. But you're one of the people who has like made your career out of being able to like. To live in all these different landscapes.
Right.
And you can, you know, wake up at 4 a.m. and, you know, tell me what is causing my React component to re-render. And most people, you know, should not have to load that amount of knowledge into their heads in order to get their job done. And so I don't really want to say that it's, like that all this stuff should immediately be thrown away. I think there's probably always going to be a place for it in some piece of like advanced pushing the browser to the edge of what it can do. Cause like JavaScript's what browsers understand. So people will be writing JavaScript forever. I just think that there are probably fewer applications that need like that need the developer to know that level of complexity than one might necessarily think. When you get to the edge of something, when you want to squeeze every FPS out of your browser engine, of course you'll want to be using JavaScript, which is why if you were building something like Anvil, you would be an idiot to think that's not true. You can't pretend that you can like sweep all the stuff under the rug and never have it come back up again. And so you've got to have like escape hatches. You've got to be able to go, okay. Actually, like right now, I want to use a library that's in JavaScript. So I want to be able to drive this JavaScript library or from my Python, or even drop out of Python, write a little bit of JavaScript without forcing you to do all of your meat and potatoes work the hard way as well. So things like, you know, I mentioned like the server-side code is like serverless, right? You write a function. In fact, you write a Python module and then you call a function in that module and Anvil takes care of causing that Python code to be loaded and running somewhere and call that function for you. That's great 95% of the time. 5% of the time, you actually really care about where that thing's running. You know, you want to run something off a GPU that's under your desk. And if you said, oh, well, our way or the highway, serverless, well, then you've just said our framework is useless to you. So what we've done is we have a library called the Uplink. It's a library you can pip install anywhere. And then if you open your app in the Anvil editor, you'll get a key. You can punch into the Uplink and it will. You can run your code locally and make function calls to your code running on your machine under your desk with the GPUs, just like you can make function calls into the serverless infrastructure. And so the idea is that like there's a set of smart defaults where you don't have to do the work, but yeah, pretending that you will never need to open an escape hatch is a recipe for creating, well, for making developers hate your guts.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. I like the concept of like, it reminds me of bumper bowling in a sense, in that
ooh,
when you're not a skilled bowler, mm-hmm, those guardrails add you tremendous benefit. Your score goes up tremendously. Look at you. Mm-hmm. You're the best bowler ever. And I don't mean this pejoratively, to be clear,
yeah, yeah,
but that when you recognize you have the skills to do stuff and you'll do things a little better if you've got that extra space and you don't need those guardrails, you can turn those off, do things that are outside of the scope of kind of being a very efficient tool for getting people that way. And you can explore those spaces, bring in different resources, do things in a little bit different way. And it allows there to be a little more stick to Anvil in that regard.
I think, like, on one hand, yes, I will take that analogy. But I think it's a little bit more like it's the difference between a chainsaw and a Stanley knife.
Okay.
Like if if what you are normally doing is cutting down trees, then you actually want something that will do that. And that is true whether or not you are an extremely talented woodcarver. You know, very few people are going to be making intricate carvings out of wood, but like obviously you're not going to want to use the same tool for both. At some point you're going to be getting out like your knife and like hand flaking away the wood. Mm. That doesn't mean that hand flaking away the wood is the best way to chop a tree down.
Interesting, yeah.
And so like a thing that we're big on is, you know, it should be something for, if you get pigeonholed for novices, like two things happen. One is that if you try to create a tool for novices, you end up being like a playpen for the kids.
Right.
It's okay if you can't do everything because it's just for learners and, you know, everything's going to be brightly colored and easy to grab hold of. And actually, like, that's great for getting novices up to speed, but it does a disservice to the novices because they're not going to actually be able to grow their powers. Like, you know, sure, a beginner developer today is a beginner today, intermediate, you know, tomorrow, advanced later on. And if you don't give them a ramp up, then you're kind of screwing them over a little bit. So you're doing them a disservice if you don't let them like get serious. And you're also doing the experienced professionals a disservice because just because I can write, you know, five different programming languages and five different frameworks to get anything done doesn't mean I particularly want to, and it doesn't mean necessarily anybody wants to wait for me to do it. And so I think it's much more in terms of like it's the 80-20 rule. Like only, you know, we probably aim for like 95-5, but do something that makes famous phrase, like the simple things easy and the hard things possible.
Yeah. I can see that. That's good.
And that doesn't mean you have to aim it at less experienced developers, even though there's a whole world of like, we call them less experienced developers, like, you know, data scientists, you know, those people, like if they have a maths PhD,
I love it.
They have like, you know, they know far more about far more difficult stuff than I will ever know.
Correct.
Just because they don't happen to have learned like the intricacies of state handling in React does not mean that they are like inexperienced or junior. it just means that, you know, they have not put the time that I've spent into that. They put it into something else and possibly something more, you know, productive for humanity. So yes, sure, absolutely, it's, you know, it is useful for them, but even for the professionals, you want to say, you know, 95% of the time, actually, this is all you need. So, like, pick this up. It's a real damn programming language. So it's really good. Yeah, you can actually do proper software engineering on it. Like, you know, the app is a Git repository. And so it's, you know, this is a real tool. Delightful user experience. And then for that 5% where you need to do, you know, to get closer to the metal, of course, you can always do that.
For those of you, and I will give this information, this small bit of context as an apology. I'd referenced us attending Strange Loop, and I'm bringing the Zoom audio in. Apparently, the infamous Richard Feldman talk has started as it fired up somehow in the background in one of my myriad tabs, and all of a sudden there's talking going. I'm like, no, stop, no. There's a good point being made, and so I apologize because that's the joys of virtual podcasting when it comes in. Is in this case, there'll be a hint of that. So I apologize for that. But I definitely agree with that sentiment, and I think it's really good. I think that there's a really cool place. It's one of the things that really excited me personally when you guys reached out about you coming on the podcast. Because, I you've actually given a talk at our local Python meetup moons ago.
Yeah, that was Chrissy, I think, invited me to that one.
Yeah, that was Chrissy. Yeah. And so when Casey and Alan found out, they're like, oh, yeah. No, we know that product. And Meredith has already given a talk at that. And so digging into that and seeing that space was really cool because we definitely align principally with a lot of everything that you're saying. I'd love to have a deeper conversation, perhaps a whole episode of what you guys are doing at the database level, because it sounds like you're just like, oh, well, Postgres, we need Python there too. And I'm just like,
okay, so this one's controversial.
Okay,
yeah,
okay. We can go in now. Let's do this.
All right, okay, yeah. I mean,
come on.
So if you are... okay, so if you use Anvil, you can open up your app and you can create a database. You can create tables with a click, and these tables and the rows in them are Python objects. They are shaped like Python objects. You query them by writing, you know, by calling a Python method. You get Python objects in response, and this has some advantages and disadvantages. One of the advantages is you do not have to drop into yet another programming language to query your data, because the awe and the terror of SQL is that you're writing, is that just to get something out of your database, you have to write a little program.
Right.
And the part of the terror is, of course, that means you have to generate source code in another programming language. And every time you're like generating source code, that is, you know, injection city. And this is, you know, how still, I think, the vast majority of sort of dumb, someone walks in through the front door and walks out with the database stuff happens because of this complexity. So that's one thing. The other is that what that means is the output of an SQL query is kind of going to be opaque to the Python surrounding it, because what shape that data is determined by like expressions written in another programming language. Whereas what you really want, if you don't want to spend all of your time translating your data between different representations, then what would it be like if everything started out as a Python object? Not just as a Python object, but as a Python object you could return from pass from server code into the client code, which is also in Python, and then directly load up into your user interface, which is also in Python. And so by not having, by default, an SQL database, we can create a world where you can grab a row from the database and pass it all the way to the front end and literally wire up, oh, this text box is mapped to the notes column of that database row, all without having to translate its representation. And so that lets you create, for example, data-driven web apps really, really fast. The other side of that is that it's not SQL, which means people who are used to being able to do like the first three quarters of their data processing in SQL are going to have to switch to doing that in Python. And like, if that's a really hard requirement for you, then I have a two-word suggestion for you, which is import PyMySQL. Import SQL, whatever. I mean, I was attempting not to get into the ORM wars, but right. Sure, why not? Let's dive straight on in.
How did you describe it? The talks I've seen when you've gone into this portion of your talk, yeah. And you talk about SQL alchemy, I forget the term you use, but basically you're saying like it's an unwarranted attack or something.
An entirely unfair pot shot.
That's it.
The thing about SQL alchemy is like it's great. It's a perfect example of this thing that we spend so much time on the web doing. Like it lets us write a query. Like, you know, I have a set of books. I can like get a bunch. So SQL Alchemy, if you're not familiar with it, it automates the translation of between rows in a database and Python objects. So instead of like generating source code for an SQL query to like select star from books where price is less than 20, you would and having to inject all the parameters there, instead you could go like book.query, you know, price is less than 20 as like a Python expression, and then you get back an iterable set of Python objects. And that's that is really cool. But the process that turns that like chain set of Python calls into an SQL query is black magic.
Right.
And, you know, the point where you write price is less than 20, book.price is less than 20 in a Python expression, and then that gets turned into source code in another programming language. I mean, that's like metaclasses right there. That's rampant operator overloading. And like anybody who's walking into this stuff for the first time, who tries to treat that, you know, that less than operator as though it were an ordinary numerical comparison, is about to have a really nasty shock, because actually it's a hideously overloaded operator doing something completely different to what it normally does onto this magic object created by a metaclass when you defined your database schema with your ORM record, and generates an intermediate object and generates source code. And it's really powerful when you know it, because when you know it, then you can take advantage of the concision and take advantage of the fact that you're all in Python. So now your autocompleter understands, you know, what data type is coming back. You don't have to drop in and parameterize an SQL query. But the flip side of that is you can only get to that productivity by having in your head at all times a model of how Python works and how SQL works and how SQL Alchemy does the translation between the two. And like, if you do that at every layer of your stack, from, you know, the database to the Python, from the Python to the JSON, from the JSON to the JavaScript, from the JavaScript to the DOM, from the DOM to the CSS, like all of those, they have frameworks for them, right?
Yep.
You know, you could name them Django REST framework, Angular resources, React, or like any templating engine. Every JavaScript framework has one, and of course they change every year. And like CSS frameworks, and all of those, like they kind of, to make it easier, they kind of abuse the semantics of one layer to represent one of the other layers. And what that means is you have to keep up with how they have twisted, you know. At that point, with SQL Alchemy, you're not really writing Python. You are using Python syntax in order to sort of communicate something into the bowels of your library that's going to spit out SQL. So you need to know about the layer and the other layer and how the translation happens all the way up and down your stack to get anything done. And that's like, that is part of what causes dents in desks when people are trying to use JavaScript.
Right. I think that's a key thing to highlight, is that we're not writing in Python. We're writing a DSL that has Pythonic syntax. An ORM is not writing in Python. An ORM is writing a DSL that is Python flavored, and they're going to go take care of all of that for you. What unholy, in the spirit of October, what unholy creature have you created that you feel like is a database that works well without SQL?
So what we did is
this is necromancer level stuff here. And I think it's very appropriate
the point
for
behind the necromancer. So the Anvil's data tables API is actually really simple.
Okay.
And because it's not like, you know, in SQL, you can do like joins, you can create these effectively like virtual tables with arbitrary conditions and cross conditions on any column. And like you have conceptually, you do like the N by M match of every row from this table to every row from that table. Then you filter it down to, you know, to which pairs happen to match the particular constraint you've defined. And of course, that's not how it actually works, but the SQL planner will take your, you know, your description of the constraint and then turn it into an efficient query plan and then do that instead. And like that, so there's a whole bunch of power and a whole bunch of complexity there. And Anvil gets to cut the knot a bit there because it just says, nope, it's a list of Python objects. Like you access Python values with, you know, column values with square brackets and you know, string indexing. There are links between tables. Yeah, if I have a record, you go, you know, record brackets owner, you just get an object that's the row from the users table. Like the referential stuff is done for you. And that does, you know, that does lose some of the power of what you can do in SQL, which is why if you want to do it in SQL, then like import an SQL library and, you know, in your Python, because it's just Python, of course you can do it and go nuts. But what you get for it in exchange is a much simpler data model. So actually implementing data tables on top of our Postgres backing store is really not that bad. You can check up the source code. It's the Anvil framework is open source. So github.com/anvil-works. And you can see like how that's done. I mean, okay. Fair warning, I'm going to give one health warning on that repository. The backend is written in Clojure because...
Oh, wow.
I know. I was... this is why I was slightly disappointed. It's Casey, isn't it, who's a bit of a Lisp head around here.
Well, actually, our biggest Lisp head is Hobbs. So we'll have to have you back to talk Lisp with Hobbs. And he'll be really excited.
Yeah, I mean, there's an excellent example of a language where you do like load yourself up with complexity and having to understand the whole system down to you know, transistors in the silicon in exchange for which you get good things. Like, I am very much not against that trade-off. But anyway, if you could wade through the Clojure, you will see how it's implemented, and it's really not that bad.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. That's like I say, you took that holy war to a whole nother level. And that is respectable. Some say foolish. I dare not say that, having not used Anvil to the degree that I feel like it is capable of. But what's fascinating to me, another thing that's fascinating, because Anvil kind of is very proximate to a lot of what we value as a consultancy or agency. Mm-hmm. In two ways. One of them is very Pythonic, and we're huge advocates of Python. We're willing to deviate in when it comes to language or framework when we feel there's a better tool for the job. But our default is to go with Python and let something else prove us wrong.
Yeah.
On the other side of that, though, because this tool is marketed specifically towards data scientists and those working within Jupyter Notebooks, like that's a place where we are very familiar as a company because it's become something that we pride ourselves on is we're not data scientists, but we're data scientists adjacent. We can speak data scientists. We can take a Jupyter notebook and give your data scientist a very caring and loving, like a parent would, or a beautiful, loving aunt, and give a smack on the wrist and be like, no, that's not sustainable. That's not scalable. That's not testable. We're going to help you rewrite this and make it something that's distributable.
Yeah.
Whereas Anvil has done a really impressive job of just saying, like, you know what? You can take that Jupyter notebook and turn it into something that is immediately valuable to the rest of the team in a way that we honestly will never do at Lofty. That's not our intent. But even though the paths are different, the end goal is very similar. And so, you know, knowing what Anvil's goal is there is really fascinating and fun to see.
So that's really fun. Like I don't want to get too much into the idea that Anvil is only for data scientists. It's for anybody who can write some Python. But data scientists are an example of that set of people. And like what I described earlier, the uplink, this idea that, hey, okay, I have something, some code or resources that's running here, and I want this to be part of my application. That's, you know, that is not just a tool for connecting Jupyter notebooks. But as it happens, it's really good for saying, you know, that point where a data scientist has like a prototype in a notebook. And you know, we've heard this story a thousand times. So, okay, imagine you're in like pharmaceuticals and the bench scientists come to you going, oh, hey, I want, you know, my job is to toxicity screen a whole bunch of compounds. I feed them to a bunch of cells and I see whether they look sick. And so I don't want to look down the microscope every day and look at those cells look sick. Can you teach a computer to recognize that for me? The scientist goes, yes, this is my bread and butter, feeds it into a bunch of machine learning models, goes and mumbles some arcane spells over it for a couple of weeks, comes back and gives a presentation where, you know, he or she loads in like a couple of micrographs and goes, look, this thing can predict whether the cells are sick. And everybody goes, well, hey, this is great. When can I get it? And the data scientist goes, that's not my department. And so you end up calling the people whose job it is to turn, like within the organization, to turn that piece of data science, typically a notebook, into a usable web app. And they go, well, we can fit you in next January for a scoping session and then we can tell you when we'll be able to fit you in for the actual development work. And just, you know, everybody holds their head in their hands and cries. And there is there's a huge jump from there to a world where the data scientist can say, actually, I have this working in my notebook. Here, let me import this library, connect this up, and I can just say, this function in my notebook, I should be able to call this function from a web app. And, you know, from a web front end. And suddenly, the difficult part in that whole job was teaching a computer to work out whether a cell line is sick. The difficult part should not be, here's a button where you can upload a PNG containing like the microscope slide, and you know, and we will produce a big text box with the score of, you know, how toxic we thought that compound was. Like, that should not be the hard part. That's what I keep coming back to when I say this like 95-5 thing. Like, the effort there should all have been in the data scientists. The effort there should not have been in building a JavaScript front end for it. And so being able to meet people where they are is important. And obviously, like at that, you know, there's going to come a point where if that becomes, you know, a scalable product they're trying to roll out as a product for other pharmaceutical companies, I don't know, then yes, you know, a bunch of Python engineers are going to come in and, you know, lovingly hold that data scientist's hand and help them turn it into something that's productionizable.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't, like, you can't say until you do that, you can't even have something working. No, like one of the biggest things we've learned in software engineering is like incremental refactoring. If you enable incremental refactoring, then everybody's life gets better. So you create a system that works when the code's in a Jupyter notebook. Well, that means people can use it, which means it's easier to make it, to make a case that it's worth putting the effort in to like refactor it, possibly even function by function. You can move bits out of that notebook into a properly hosted serverless environment that's, you know, versioned and deployed and, you know, amenable to CI/CD. And you can do that step by step until all the things in the serverless environment. And at no point did you have to, like, you know, pull a lever, honk a big ship's horn and say, time to rewrite this thing. It's, if you meet people, and that's the other advantage of being accessible to novices and usable by seasoned pros. If you meet people where they are and give them a path from there in the same system to something that's actually production quality and deployable, then you've taken a whole bunch of roadblocks away from people without cramping the professional style.
That's good. I like that. I like that space. As a company that relies heavily on MVP and are huge mm-hmm. advocates of MVP, because we have clients come to us and they're just like, build everything all at once.
Yes.
Of course, as software clients often do. And we have to
I have
go
a vision,
through the process.
Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which one's got top priority? All of them.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. People forget how prioritization works. It's fun. It's cute.
I have to take my hat off to you, because like one thing we are firmly not in is the consulting business. And occasionally people people come to us and say, hey, you built a really good tool. Can you help us build our app? And we say, oh, God, no.
So
we have a bunch of consultants who we respect because they are the people who can do that thing of steering people through. No, actually, what's the most important? Come on, you're going to have to put these in an order.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we go through great lengths to help our clients there. And we found that it's something that's done us tremendous good and our clients as well, as we can kind of all kind of face the reality of things versus the fun flurry of, oh, we're excited, we found this tool, or we've got someone who can produce this information. And now we can, now that we're all in the software world, we can dream real big and we can be the next, what have you. And helping people realize like that's not a process that just kind of happens overnight. It's something we do in our consulting, and so we help them focus on an MVP. And so like a tool, that's where a tool like Anvil, because particularly as it relates to taking something very complex in a Jupyter notebook and creating an MVP that's instantly testable. Like you believe this to be valuable, you cannot get it to the rest of your team. We cannot get that to the rest of your team without building you custom software. However, there are tools like Anvil, which will allow you to expose the value of that Jupyter notebook to the rest of your team to confirm that value and prove viability of the product, to just lean into all letters but the M. That brings value. And so like there's definitely places where it's just like, oh man, that's a fantastic tool to help us as we are helping people understand how software works, to say, do you have something that genuinely contributes value? Here's a way to quickly. And that's not to say that Anvil is exclusively an MVP tool. I don't want to.
Yeah, but I think the trick is to make something that is sufficiently straightforward to that you can build your MVP in it without it being like, you know, Fisher Price toys, so you couldn't scale it up.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the goal.
Yeah, it's definitely not Tinker Toys from what I've seen. And I see the work gone in there, and like even like the front end templating where I was looking at it, I was like, oh, this looks good. And it's like, this looks like material. And then I see you selecting templates for material. Yeah. I was like, somebody's touched the JavaScript here. It's definitely.
Oh yeah.
Well, like, somebody's got a dent on their table. This is
so,
not me.
Like somebody is. Yeah. And like the way you define a theme in Anvil is you go in and you go and write the HTML and you write the JavaScript. You don't write the HTML and CSS that go in. Sorry. Spoil my own punchline. Sorry.
That's right.
You don't like edit the HTML that comes out. You edit the HTML that goes in. So if you do write the HTML, then you create something like, you know, the material design theme. But what you do is you include, you know, sort of placeholders for, okay, and here is where the Python component goes. And so you can do the design, you can get pixel perfect, you can nerd out on your CSS, you can do, you know, you can do the usual eye-watering stuff. But when you've done with that, you can still jump into the drag and drop designer and put your UI within it, which means you don't lose the agility or the ability for somebody else on your team who only speaks Python to edit your application. You have just like created a template into which their work can go. And again, like that's just, I will bang on about escape hatches all day as a really like possibly the most important thing people miss out on when they're trying to make something simpler. But you can like the way to make, say, like if you want to take something to the edge, you want to get something pixel perfect. Yeah, you're going to need CSS. Does that mean you need CSS every time you say no? That button should be underneath that text box. Of course it doesn't. Like that's what the drag and drop design is good for.
Yeah, that's awesome. Knowing where to differentiate, I think that's powerful, because I think that's an exciting space, to explore, because I know I want to kind of lean into that as we're talking with folks and saying, like, because there's a place where we obviously as we, especially as a consultancy, we lean more into geospatial stuff. There's spaces where that's just not going to be something that's, at least to this point, something that Anvil can do as a platform.
Yeah.
So there's a place for that handoff. And so finding those synergies is really, really great, especially in our, what we call our ignition phase, where we're dealing with clients and helping them understand how custom software works and whether or not they need to do it and whether or not there are tools off the shelf that can benefit them. Because we literally try and talk all of our clients out of custom software because they're going to become a they're going to become a software company whether they want to or not the moment they have custom software. And people don't realize that. They think it's like buying a couch. It's like, that's a great couch we bought. And it's just like, why is my couch not booted? What's going on with my couch? No one can sit on my couch. Yeah. And it's just like, that's because you have custom software. That's not how couches work.
You haven't bought a thing. You bought a job.
Yeah, exactly. But no one wants to hear that. And so finding those places where we can help them bridge that gap is just like, man, that's super. So that's
you do geospatial. I'm sorry. I'm going to tangent you again.
No, please do. Please do.
It's the podcast for it.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll run all over the place. You haven't told us anything about burritos or
you don't even know what you like to eat yet.
So here's the thing. Are you in Cambridge currently?
Yes.
Okay. So you need to give us information about Indian food. We talk about Mexican food and burritos because we're here in the States. Obviously, Indian food is the equivalent in the UK. So we need some hot takes on curry after you've given us your information.
Okay. Right. Yes. Absolutely. On this tangential. So no, the geospatial stuff at Tangent was that I don't know if you're users of Mapbox.
Yep.
Yeah, so my colleague Brooke actually did a live stream with the Mapbox crew where she just said, hey, I want to do a geospatial app. I want to do, it was a demo of like they have an isochrone API where you can go, like, I start from here. Oh, I'm on a bicycle. How far can I get in 20 minutes? That kind of thing, which is, under the nearest bus is the answer to that question. And she like built that app from scratch, like on a live stream because... Obviously, like all the UI for, where displaying where you are, choosing, I want the 20-minute isochrone for a car. That you could all do in Python with Anvil and the drag and drop designer. And then she went, okay, for the map stuff, I'm just going to, from anvil.js import mapbox, and then suddenly you've got this JavaScript object in your Python and she just throws the rest into the mapbox API. And like in the course of like a 20-minute live stream, she has like a fully interactive app that's exploring, scroll around, geocode, search a place.
How dare you?
Get an isochrone.
How dare you come on our podcast and kill our children in front of us? Give us the damn link so people can come watch them do this. Give us a link, whatever.
I'm giving you the link.
Uh-huh.
All right, I'm giving you the link, and then I'm going to tell you where you can get a decent curry in Cambridge. I mean,
all right,
I'm not going to be the top expert on this, but your top ones are the Tiffin truck, which is on Regent Street, which is the road that like sort of wends in and becomes like the ancient medieval marketplace of Cambridge. That's a really good one. Or Zara. It's actually like there's one. It's in a village just outside Cambridge, where it's like not that far to get to. It's actually in like a converted station building. So there's the train line to London runs through a whole bunch of little villages, and sometimes it stops and sometimes it doesn't. And in one of the stations where these days it doesn't stop that much, and it's not like you need a lot of ticket staff because everyone buys the ticket with a credit card or on the app. They took the station building and they turned it into a restaurant.
Nice.
And that restaurant serves, as far as I'm concerned, one of the best curries you can get in Cambridshire.
Nice. What's your curry? What's your go-to curry?
Oh, too many. The problem is you encounter a really good place. I am far too white to have a very educated opinion on this stuff. But also, you go to a place that's good enough, you put a blindfold on, throw a dart at the menu, and it's going to come out interesting. I am a Passanda fan, but don't hold me to that, because next time I'm going to close my eyes, stick my finger on something, and discover something I never knew existed.
Yeah, that's good.
I think, I don't know, okay, this is a question, again, this is three white guys talk about ethnic food. Let's see how badly we can get ourselves stuck.
We'll get good and stuck. I appreciate it.
How much uniformity is there, like, in like the quote unquote Mexican cuisine in the US? Because like in casual visits, I get the sense of uniformity.
It depends on what you get.
Yeah,
it depends on what you get. So probably kind of one of the uniform things out there I know of is fajitas. If I'm going to a new Mexican restaurant and I don't really know what to get, I haven't eaten anything, like I'm probably safe with fajitas. Now, I'm in a small town called Elkins, and just down the road, we have a Mexican restaurant, and they make a devastation burrito. You can get a 10-inch.
That sounds dangerous.
The 14-inch, and then it's got curly fries on it.
Very un-Mexican for what
it's worth. Yep. And guacamole. So it's like cheese fries on top of your burrito. You know, that's kind of the gambit of
Am I destroying any chance of ever coming on this podcast again if I say that is the most American thing I have ever heard?
No, you're 100% right. You've almost guaranteed coming back on the podcast and recognizing
as far
that.
As I'm concerned.
No, we have several reasons we need you back on. If nothing else, to educate you about terrible American Mexican food. Fajitas are kind of the chicken tikka masala of the Mexican world. Is just like, oh yeah, that's consistent. Yep. I can go with that. We're good there. But then you vary, and then American Mexican food is in no way authentic. We have delicious things that we enjoy that have quote unquote Mexican flavors, but most of those are inauthentic. Yeah. And it doesn't help that Taco Bell literally will take a thing that is a known entity in the actual cuisine of Mexico. And then just like, that name's awesome, but that food sucks. So we're going to take that name and put it on something we've created, chalupa, gordita, variety of things. And so no one in the US who hasn't visited Mexico regularly or been involved in a heavily Latinx culture isn't going to recognize how unauthentic our food is. But yeah, it's the moment you had curly fries and cheese dip, you're in a distinctly American space, which is still delicious, but very un-Mexican.
So, okay, here's the thing. Like, clearly, there is, like, food engineering going into that question.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would pay so much to be a fly on the wall when they sit there and have the meeting. Like, it's clearly they don't sit down there and twirl their mustaches and go, ha, 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 here we are. We're going to ruin a beloved everybody's beloved dish their grandma made by giving its name to something completely different. We like, there's clearly a plan, and there is like, there are considerations. There's like people thinking about how to engineer this into a mass produced food that's going to be popular over a country whose size boggles my mind. Like, don't you ever, like, sometimes you knowing how like your clients think about software, you must think, you must like pass so many things in the world. You think, there are clearly like engineers who spent that amount of sweat on a thing that I no more understand on their level than one of my clients coming to me going, but make it do everything. I don't understand why you can't just do that and have it ready by tomorrow.
Yeah. That's I like
all
that
all the time.
I like the thought of the like chef for Taco Bell corporate. Where they're just like, make us a gordita, and they make an authentic one. It's like, nah, that thing sucks. Make it like this. And they're just like, that's not a gordita. And they're just like, I don't care. Make it like this. And then they make it. And they're like, this is it. This is a gordita. It's like, but no, that's not a gordita. That's a thing you had me make, but it's not a gordita. And they said, we don't care. It's a gordita now. It's above your pay grade. We're going to take your recipe and we're going to call it this. So, and then that person quits Taco Bell and goes goes into the desert in a van and hangs out with Casey for 6 weeks at a time.
Yeah, I noticed he didn't join us in the middle. Do you have any idea where he is this week?
Somewhere in Utah with an oil leak. He was meant to be here, and he had an oil leak in his RV, and we're sad that he didn't make it, but he'll be back soon and with a fully functioning RV, we hope. This has been a beautiful grand experiment. Not just on the podcast, but also like in the office for our founder and CEO to go digital nomad and live that life. And he's had a great time. His family's had a great time. We're really happy for them and things are going well here. So all he does now is he's just like close sales and then shows up and he's just like, there's sand everywhere. And that's like, that's Casey's life now. It's great. He's doing a great job of all of those things and so much more because he's probably listening to this podcast. So I have to make sure he feels confident that I'm nicely representing his efforts well. Yeah. He's doing great. So
awesome.
Well, Meredith, thank you so much for your time. We will absolutely have you back on if you'll come to talk about all kind of cuisine. We're going to have to get our JavaScript champion Blake in here to come have epic battles with you.
Oh, that's fine as long as I get your as long as I get to talk to your list maniac as well, Ben. I think
we'll bring we got to get you on here with Hobbs. We got to get you on here with Blake. There's so many future episodes that we're really looking forward to. The first of many. Meredith. Oh, and this is key because we need this. We started kind of in this area. And you need to explain to uneducated Americans why the double D has a TH sound in your name.
Okay, so this is definitely not an Americans versus English thing because my name is Welsh. It's spelled so
MERDYDD. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Okay, cool. So carry on.
So Welsh is one of these languages. It's like Polish. It is 100% always phonetic.
Yeah.
It's just that the letters it's written down with make like native English speakers sort of cross their eyes and go a funny color. And so my name is Easy. As long as you know that a Y is pronounced I and a double D is pronounced th. So it's Meredith. If you're a native English speaker and you're trying to pronounce it, you just start with the name Meredith and then you think the word red loudly in the middle of it and you get there.
Yeah.
A friend taught me that one after like my, so I used to do like competitive dancing and my first ever dance partner we moved together very well. We got on very well as friends, but my goodness, she had such trouble saying my name until she got that. But honestly, at this point, I've got to a point where you know my reception filter for something that's vaguely shaped like my name is very large. Anything with an M at the beginning and three syllables, I will turn round. Friends have tested this.
that's amazing. It reminds me, so the way you describe that is very accurate because there's a whole host of names and languages that have that kind of thought kind of triggering sounds. So for example, I have a friend named Banga who is from, and this is going to sound so diverse and super American to be like, he's either Nigerian or Kenyan. And Banga, if you're hearing this, I apologize if I don't remember what nation it is, whether it be Nigeria or Kenya, because I recognize how varied they are. However, the way that Banga has you know how to say his name correctly is it's Banga, like you would think with me to saying Banga, but there's an N in front of it. And so to say the name correctly, and this is with a lot of names from that region, you say the N in your head, and then you say the rest of the name. And in doing so, phonetically, you like your mouth is shaped in such a way that you say his name like he has heard it his entire life. Whereas if you just call him Banga, he's just like, it's not a B, there's an N there. And it's just like, yeah, but you don't say the N. And he's just like, no, but you say it in your head and then it makes sense. And you're just like, Banga. Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. That is bizarrely different. And you're right. And then you recognize like, we just don't know how to use all our letters sometimes here in the States. So it is what it is. Or anywhere where we speak English. So I would argue
languages are weird and wonderful and like knowing like people who do linguistics always have just like the weirdest anecdotes for you'll never guess what this this random language does with these letters or with like the sound of the human mouth, like nobody else makes this sound, but they all know how to do it.
I was going to say that's part of why I was an English major. I had a teacher who went to the trouble of explaining the differences with all of that, with Greek and Latin and all the various languages.
Oh, yeah.
Captivating. So I did that so I could come write software.
One of our developer advocates, actually Brooke, the one who did the Mapbox stream I was talking about earlier, has a linguistics degree. And so she came in via natural language processing, to data science, to machine learning,
Everything I'm doing is in Python. I may as well go work for this Python chap.
Something like that, yes. But yes, like those stories of, like, you know, it feels like America's Funniest Home Videos linguistics edition sometimes. Oh, yeah.
Well said. Excellent. All right. Well, it's been great having you on. We've enjoyed the conversation. We look forward to more of them. And like I say, we will schedule our champions so that we don't waste your time with just me and Alan, and you can have deep level
ethic food is never a waste of time, Terrell.
Well, that's I would agree.
So
you get the ethos of this podcast, and for that we are grateful.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really great being here. If you want to check out Anvil yourself and want a little bit more of a structured view than my ramblings on the topic, you can check it out at anvil.works. We have a ton of tutorials and guides to building it. My email address, if you can spell my name, I gave you the hint earlier, is Meredith at anvil.works.
I'll put it in the title. I'll make it easy.
There you go.
Plus anvil.works. Yeah. /learn has a lot of resource. I can say that as someone who's been there and appreciated the combination of documents, videos, all of the things that you've provided there are very helpful.
My PyCon talk this year was about, like, hey, if you're making something for developers, documentation, it's really freaking important.
Yep.
Anyway,
the Anvil YouTube channel is really good for that kind of stuff too. You've got quite a few PyCon talks up there. And a variety of information. So,
well, I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But yes, I'm going to go on all evening if you let me.
Yep. Well, we'll stop there.
Might as well say,
you've got
thank
more
you so much for having me.
You bet. All right. Well, hey, thanks so much. Have a great one.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow @FridayDeploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@hirelofty.com.